family-owned shop in Loganville, Soasby's Garage, for all your automotive repair needs. We service all makes and models, foreign and domestic. We repair engines, alternators, brakes, alignments, AC systems, and more, using certified technicians with over 90 years of combined experience. We also offer same-day service for some repairs. Soasby's Garage, 200 Bay Creek Road in Loganville. Dependable, honest, and fair. Look us up on Google or Facebook. We'll take good care of you.
Broadcasting live from the Subaru of Gwinnett studio inside the Sonesta Gwinnett Place Atlanta Hotel, it's time for Case in Point, presented by Paradigm Security Services. We are the cornerstone of security in the Southeast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Case in Point, presented by Paradigm Security Services. I'm your host, Rick Strawn, the president of Paradigm Security Services. We're excited to be with you today on Business Radio X. We're broadcasting live from the Subaru of Gwinnett studio, located in the beautiful Sonesta Gwinnett Place Atlanta Hotel in Duluth, Georgia. In addition to Paradigm Security, this show is also brought to you by Soasby's Garage, as you just heard. And also, every other week between my shows, the Manna Scholarship Fund. Check out Dr. Jeannie Burnett. On every show, we feature businesses and organizations in the Atlanta area, especially those that serve Gwinnett County, as well as the people. While all businesses and have security concerns, not all are about physical security, and we'll touch on that and other related aspects of security through the course of our shows. You know, today we have a lot of things going on. Elections are coming up. There's just a lot of things going on in our county here in Gwinnett and really around the state. And one of the things that we try to do as we move through this season is to have some of the people that want to have your vote, want to go on through the politics thing and get in there and work for you. And we like to kind of give you an idea of what some of those issues are, where they stand, and how that goes. So with that in mind, I want to welcome Brian Gatewood to the show today. Brian, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. And just real quick, everybody does it. It's Byron.
What did I say?
You said Brian.
I'm sorry.
Everyone,
I'm looking at it.
My mom does it. It's okay.
Yeah, I'm looking at it and seeing Byron and said Brian. It's Byron Gatewood.
Yes, sir.
My apologies. And I know that. It was a screw up on my part. He's running for the 6th District Congressional seat here in Georgia. And, you know, that is a pretty good size area on the 6th District, and especially with the redos of the districts. I like to always start out with, you know, just in a kind of a nutshell synopsis, who is Byron Gatewood? I almost did it again.
You almost did it again. Yeah, no, it's very common. Everybody does it. Don't sweat it, please. I am a guy from a little town who worked hard and got somewhere. You know, I to introduce myself probably best, I have to go back 20 years to a moment where, you know, that I think changed a lot of lives forever. September 11th, 2001, you know, we all know where we were that day. Mm-hmm. That was a turning point in our nation's history. But for me as an individual, it was really that, you know, that crystallizing moment where I became an adult. You know, I was kind of still a kid right up to that point. And then something happened that changed the course of my life. And I, you know, I took that anger and that rage that I felt after seeing us attacked, and I enlisted in the National Guard at the time because I was still in college, and, you know, wasn't ready, I thought, to be a full-time soldier. Little did I know that I was about to be a full-time soldier.
It has a way of surprising you with the Guard, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does, especially after, you know, they mobilized the whole Guard for a, you know, a national campaign like that to go beat the Taliban. But that was really where I grew up, was in Afghanistan. And, you know, I was lucky enough to come home. A lot of guys and girls didn't get the opportunity to come back. And came back, you know, got back into school, commissioned onto active duty. And then my wife and I, you know, spent several years on active duty building a family, one duty station at a time, going, you know, from Virginia to Arizona to Kansas and all around the U.S., ultimately spent about 4 years in Germany, where I did a lot of good work in the intelligence field, in Eastern Europe and Israel. We'll talk probably some about that in the course of our conversation. And then I, you know, got out of the active service, went and got my MBA at Cornell, and have gone into business for myself. You know, I live in East Cobb where we're raising a family. I've got four kids. We just added number four via adoption. And I'm a biblical conservative raising a family along those lines. That's how I feel my policy should be crafted. You know, as a member of Congress, those are the politicians I tend to vote for and support generally, is people I feel that live up to a certain moral code. And that's how I run my business, how I run my family. That's who I am.
Well, you know, it requires a lot. And you mentioned part about being a small business owner. Mm-hmm. And in today's atmosphere, I can tell you as a small business owner mm-hmm. myself, you know, getting people to work, getting people once they get to work to work, just getting them to come in and come to through our academy that we have and actually go out mm-hmm. and get in patrol and do the job. It's a challenge, and it's something that just does not it's not getting a lot better. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's getting any better. It may have proved – I can tell you after the next 2-3 weeks because it looks like there may be a little bit of movement in it. Right. But, you know, that's something that you're going to have to work with, to deal with when you get in the position, if you're lucky enough to be elected, mm-hmm. that's going to have to be dealt with. Kind of how do you look at that particular facet of trying to get people back to work, which is important to Georgia?
It's hugely important to Georgia. It's important to Georgians, you know. One of the jobs that I have right now is I help run and I work with a nonprofit that creates jobs for adults in the autism spectrum.
Awesome.
And we partner. It's really cool, actually. I'm really proud of it.
I've got a grandson that's autistic.
And autism at this point touches every family. You know, absolutely. Everybody has a cousin or an uncle or a nephew or something that you know, we've all been touched by autism. And so what we do is we partner with corporate clients and we do data work. You know, this is a population of people who frequently kind of the stereotype diagnosis is that affinity for repetitive task, attention to detail, that, you know, that comfort level with technology. And that makes them good candidates for data work, data management,
absolutely.
And things like that. So what we do is partner with corporate clients, and we do data management work that would otherwise get farmed out overseas. Mm-hmm. And we've created this environment where folks who are generally overlooked in the labor market, you know, this is a population that's vastly underemployed, vastly unemployed, despite having some marketable skills.
Vastly underrated.
And yeah, very much so, yes, sir. And we've created an environment where they can thrive, where they can grow professionally, develop the soft skills, develop the hard skills, and get good work done, rewarding work, and quality of life improvement. But for a couple of years now, you know, we've had an incentive structure that has sent this population and everyone else at home and paid people to stay mm-hmm. home, or scared people into staying home. And this is in policy making and fear mongering that's in direct conflict with human flourishing.
Absolutely.
You know, not just for this population, maybe especially for this population, but it's good for everyone to be out. Everyone to
be
working.
You need that social interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're creatures who were designed to go out and do good work. You know, whether it's a universal basic income argument or whatever it is, like, this is not good policy. Like, we need to go create and do things for ourselves.
Well, we've got to have that, like I said, that personal interaction, mm-hmm. especially important for kids growing up mm-hmm. to learn how to interact, how to interface with kids their own age, mm-hmm. with older and younger kids. And I know from it being associated with someone that has the autism, and he's on the high intellect level of mm-hmm. autistic, you know, he has his issues. He's working to control them and all
sure.
that learning. It's come with maturity, but it's something that they deal with every day. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have that interaction, they don't learn how to deal with mm-hmm. it. Tell us, you've told me a little bit about your military experience. Can you tell me how that basically prepared you to be an effective member of Congress?
Yeah, it's a great question. Baseline, it's about leadership. You know, it's about putting people in situations to make the hard decision, you know, and as a voter for me and I would hope this would be the case with other voters, it's putting people in office who you can be reasonably confident will rise to that occasion, you know, and speak up and take the hard right over the easy wrong and step into the void, you know, and get things done. You know, I think easy, for instance, there is what it takes to send our young people to go serve and fight and die on foreign soil, you know, and after 20 years, almost 20 years in the U.S. Army in some capacity or another, I'm still in, by the way, in the reserves.
Thank you for your service.
I appreciate that. You know, but after 20 years, I think I'm equipped to approach that decision with a proper respect for the gravity of what it means. You know, I'm 80% disabled from the VA. I know what it means to come back with some scars inside and outside, you know, and before we, it doesn't mean it's never the right answer. You mm-hmm. know, sometimes we do have to do that. We've got a standing army for a reason, but that's not something you just run into willy-nilly without proper respect for the service members, the families, and what it means to put people in harm's way.
Put a lot of thought into it before you move, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. unlike some things that are going on.
And one of the things that's required to put proper consideration there is understanding the threats we face, you know, and I've spent my career as an Army intelligence officer looking at those threats. You know, I've studied China closely at the academic level. Actually, part of my master's thesis was on the rise of the Chinese threat. I've studied Russia closely in my intelligence work, in the intelligence field. And, you know, in that confluence of, you know, academic experience and real world, you know, intelligence on the ground experience, I think makes me uniquely qualified to weigh those considerations closely, you know. And at this point, I think every Republican running for office everywhere is talking about border security. You know, you got school board candidates talking about border security because it's topical and it's important to folks. But how many of those candidates have ever worked border security? I have, you know, and it didn't happen to be our southern border. It was actually a border between Turkey and Syria. That's a little stickier.
That's fairly volatile.
Yeah. And, but I've got a pretty good understanding of, you know, what it takes from a tiered security strata to secure that type of border.
Well, I know from being in law enforcement and being in the security field now, the primary thing that you got to start with is a threat assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't get a full, logical, in-place threat assessment, then you're starting from behind the eight ball to start with.
Yep.
And which is kind of what I've seen experienced in the Afghanistan. There was not a full threat assessment done. And if there was, it sure wasn't anything paid attention to it.
Yeah. Well, and that's the tragedy, is that there was a risk assessment. There was a threat assessment. We did understand what the Taliban was going to do. And people were trying to get heard. And
nobody was listening.
The guy at the
top
wasn't. At
least the main guy wasn't. And that's something, I mean, you've been over there. So, you know, give me your thoughts on what happened with Afghanistan as far as from both a citizen mm-hmm. and also as a soldier.
Yeah. So
combine the two is one. It's the same.
Yeah. And that's an important thing that you said there. There's not a clear distinction for me between citizen and soldier, because I've been both my entire adult life. And watching us throw away the good work that we did. You know, we, after 9/11, after we were attacked, we secured the area. You know, we locked down the Taliban. The Taliban is an ideology. You know, it's not just a group of people. You're never going to exterminate that any more than we can ever exterminate racism or anti-Semitism or anything else. Like, you're never going to completely crush a thing like that. But we shut them down, and we were safe for 20 years. The world was safe for 20 years. Before we just decided to kind of punt on it and sell them out. Little girls went to school. Terrorist attacks were not planned in Afghanistan for 20 years. And so to watch us just give that away over the course of about a week, it seemed like, and get nothing in return. You know, we were instantly less safe. And as an intelligence professional who's been a little closer to this than the average bear, I know how much less safe we are. And it's a lot less safe.
Oh, absolutely. You know?
And then from a power projection standpoint, knowing that China's going to swoop right in because they don't care about the human rights violations. They don't care about any of that. And so, you know, regionally, we project less power. But then beyond that, you know, looking at our other relationships, you know, being a part of building those relationships on the ground in Afghanistan and knowing that we sold those folks out, you know, to die. But we've got, you know, there are 30 countries in NATO. That's 29 partners who've got to be doing a hard look at their relationship with the United States, saying, well, will the U.S. keep their word? You know, whether it's, you know, our oldest allies like Great Britain or France or some of the former Eastern Bloc countries like Latvia, Lithuania, who depend on us. And frankly, who we depend on, they don't know if they can count on us to keep our word. Israel, our most important ally in a tremendously volatile region. And I've done a lot of work with Israel. You know, the folks in the IDF have to be given their relationship with the U.S. a hard look. Can we count on these guys? And right now, I don't think they can.
Well, how can some of those ideas, concerns, everything be transferred down to the local area and the stuff that you're going to have to do as a local congressman? Mm-hmm. How do those, some of that stuff that you learned in that area are going to help you in that in particular area on a local level?
Yeah, a lot of it's going to be driving policy, you know, how we draw up foreign policy, how we approach the countries that we need. And to be frank, I just listed, you know, our allies. Mm-hmm. Every country in the world needs to understand that the U.S. keeps its word. You know, our adversaries need to understand that the U.S. keeps its word. That they can only push so far because we will do what we say we're going to do. You know, and some of that is policymaking in the houses of Congress. Some of that's holding the executive branch accountable, because ultimately those matters of state, that's all of that, that runs through the DOD and all that, that comes up through the commander in chief. And we've seen what massive failures from the commander in chief can lead to. But it's about accountability and being, whether it's in policymaking or being the person on TV raising the alarm, you know, the president isn't doing what he's supposed to do, which is the case currently.
Well, the pandemic has hit. We'll move on to a little bit different here. Mm-hmm. The pandemic has hit everybody hard in every facet of life, mm-hmm. but particularly in the business area. Now, you're in a business. I'm sure you were affected as well. What can we do on a local basis to help influence us getting back into the normal, mm-hmm. as a Georgia congressman?
That's really, yeah. So, you know, my wife and I own a couple of small businesses, and we own a gym and we own a travel agency. And I'm sure you and I
can, both affected greatly.
I'm sure you and I could sit here long enough to come up with an industry that was more impacted than fitness centers and, you know, travel and hospitality.
It'd take a while,
but it would take a minute. and you know, and some of that was inevitable. You know, there was a worldwide pandemic. People were afraid. There were reasons that, you know, reasonable restrictions, all of that. But so much has been driven on government mandates and overreach and these blanket mandates that applied to all businesses or mm-hmm. all industries, you know, irrespective of how they might affect different things, different ways. And then the misinformation and the constant contradictions from either government mouthpieces or their counterparts in the mainstream media. And it's been so damaging. You know, 2 years ago, February of 2020, if you look at the small business landscape then to now, over a third, 34% of small businesses are shuttered mm-hmm. in America since then. How many careers is that? You know, how many life savings is that? How many jobs are just gone, you know, forever based on this whole thing? And we'll never be able to really sort out the data and know how much of that was really necessary, but a lot of it wasn't. You know, and so getting things back to local control, and this is for a member of the federal government, you know, the seat that I'm running for, the job there is getting that control away from, wresting that control away from the Faucis and the federal level organizations, and getting that down to the state and the local level where communities can make decisions on what's best for communities. Because you can't run rural Georgia like Manhattan or D.C. They're just right. Not the same area. You know, they're not subject to the same risks. They're just too different. And to have, you know, the head of the CDC or Anthony Fauci or come out, make blanket statements that are supposed to apply to every American in every situation, that's just not smart.
Well, we just had information, you know, from the reviews and stuff come out that, it, what was it, 0.02 or 0.2% of the fatalities, mm-hmm. it would have been changed if we hadn't done a complete lockdown.
Right.
So it was such infinitesimal. Now, I agree that we did not know that in the beginning. We had to do what we had mm-hmm. to do based on, and it was based on recommendations from Fauci, mm-hmm. which we all know have been terrible from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But at least we know now, you know, hindsight's wonderful. But, you know, from a level of being a U.S. congressman, you're going to have input on the directions in which this goes. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you can help to assist to get us out of this fear-based stuff. Who is a current legislator on the federal or state levels that you would like to emulate the style or policy and priorities of, if, in fact, you want to emulate anyone?
Yeah, I'm glad you phrased it like that. Yeah, I'm glad you phrased it like that, because I got to be me. You know, I'm a lot of personality. I got a lot of energy. And I think, you know, based on some of the stuff we've talked about, I'm going to bring a lot of experience and some earned expertise to the seat. And so, you know, the idea of trying to fall into the mold of another person is just not my style, you know? And right now, everybody in Congress on both sides are held completely hostage by leadership. You know, and I want to break that stranglehold on the power and represent the people of Georgia 6. You know, I'm going to have, the way I see it, about 800,000 bosses mm-hmm. when I'm in Congress, and none of them are a party leader. None of them are, you know, the speaker. My 800,000 bosses live, you know, in Forsyth and Dawson and Cherokee and Cobb and North Fulton. And those are the people that I'm accountable to. So going out of my way to emulate somebody else or to try to be like somebody else when what I want to do is represent the people I represent, that feels like the most genuine way to approach this.
That's a good answer, because, you know, I think there's too many people nowadays want to – I really think would have answered that more of a, well, I like the way this guy does it, mm-hmm. and, you know, I want to be like him. And I don't think there's a single person in office right now that we need to emulate. I think we need to have some people in there that's mm-hmm. fresh blood.
Yeah.
People in there with fresh ideas.
Yeah. And Congress doesn't do anything right now.
Exactly.
You know, we hadn't passed a budget in 20 years. We pass massive spending bills. Nobody's putting thought into legislation. And if the legislature doesn't legislate, then our three branches of government are rendered kind of incompetent there. And so, yeah, we've got to get back to basics and just get back to civics class.
I'd like to see us get back to trying to balance a budget. We're required to do it on a personal basis.
Yep.
So,
wouldn't that be amazing?
As a business, if I don't balance a budget in mm-hmm. some way, we're out of business. Mm-hmm. Well, the federal government's going to eventually get out of business if we don't get a balanced budget going. And I'd love to see some people do that. Once elected, if you could hypothetically only focus on one issue, what would — and that's just hypothetically, because I know there's a lot of them that mm-hmm. you're interested in — what would that issue be?
I do have a lot of, you know, a lot of priorities and a lot of things that I think are important for us to focus on. But for me personally, and I touched on it earlier, I'm a biblical conservative. That's who I am. And so for me, it's the life issue. You know, if I could pick one thing to get through, it would be that issue of the sanctity of life. It's deeply personal to me. It's not a talking point. It's not a political point to score. I know it's, you know, I'm running as a Republican, it's the right answer, but it's theological, and it's driven by something deeper. You know, my pro-life story starts at the very beginning. I was born to a scared, poor teenage mom in a bad relationship, and she kept me, you know, and gave me a chance. And that's a big deal. You know, like, I can't mm-hmm. overstate that, really. And she worked hard and created a good life for me. The man who eventually married us was adamant about adopting me. He didn't want to be a stepdad. He wanted to be a dad, and he adopted me. He himself was adopted, you know, and adoption continues to be part of my story and my family now. You know, we brought home baby number four. It was our first adoption, though, from India a couple months ago.
That's awesome.
And so, you know, so the life issue and overturning Roe is a beautiful first step, but it's only a first step to the journey to be a life-affirming culture.
Awesome. Well, you know, and that is important to so many people right now. One thing I would like to ask you also, in addition to that, is, you know, one of the big issues right now is our immigration, illegal immigration. Mm-hmm. I am absolutely on board with legal immigration. I think it's what made our country. But illegal immigration is killing us.
Indeed.
And right now I read something earlier before the show of a tremendous increase in the pandemic, the COVID positive, well, actually COVID sicknesses within the immigration, mm-hmm. illegal immigration facilities and camps. What's your position on that? I know your position, but how would you deal with it?
Well, I mean, the first thing we talked about a little bit already is border security. You know, I mean, right now we don't have a border policy. And by not having a border policy, that's the border policy.
That is a problem.
You know, and that's, I mean, you know, and so whether it's completing structure and walls and fences and physical obstructions to getting over, but that's only part of a solution. You know, it's a tiered multi-level solution that involves everything from, you know, automated drones to agents on horseback. You know, it's border security is an active engagement. That's almost a front to a war zone, especially in a situation where we've got what we've got thanks to the Biden policies. You know, and of course they're bringing over COVID. This is an unregulated set of people who end up in close quarters, who end up in unsafe conditions.
And unregulated conditions.
Yeah. And so they're bringing over, sure, they're bringing over COVID. They're bringing over a lot worse than COVID.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so yeah, it's a situation that's got to end. Attention has to be brought to it. And we need people creating policy there who know what they're doing. Because right now we don't have it.
We need strong people and strong mm-hmm. personalities that can put up and stand up against mm-hmm. some of these people that are in charge and mm-hmm. have not done anything, aren't doing anything besides talk. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a lot of talk, just no action. Mm-hmm. Would you say Joe Biden has been effective in any area of his presidency so far? And kind of second on that, what issues would you see yourself working with him on?
You know what? I would like to be that bipartisan guy who can point out and really ferret out the thing that Joe Biden has done well. Unfortunately, he's not given me the opportunity. You know, he's done nothing well.
It's called a brain teaser.
Yeah, it's been abject failure from front to back. You know, if we look at foreign policy, we can start in Afghanistan, but, you know, we talked about that. But then, you know, our adversaries are emboldened. China is emboldened. North Korea is launching missiles toward Japan.
Right and left.
You know, we're back in a situation where Russia's about to slice off another little piece of Ukraine because they can, you know, and so on down the line. The border's a travesty. Internally, you're probably saving for retirement, but you're further away from it than you were a year ago.
Absolutely.
Because all of your money is worth 7 to 10% less, you know? People at every stage of life, whether it's, you know, getting close to retirement, sending kids to school, building a house, starting a business, whatever, your savings are worth less. Everything about this Biden administration, he was going to come in and shut down the virus. You know, what a, of all the quotes that haven't aged well, like, it's just been more fear-mongering and more of the same.
That was a point to get elected by.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's no way in the world that was ever going to happen.
No. But so no. You know, Joe Biden has been an abject failure a year in. It's been maybe the worst first year any president has had since, I mean, like, Lincoln's first year was pretty bad. The Civil War started. That was a tough run. But other than that, like, and all of Joe Biden's stuff has been self-inflicted. You know, mm-hmm. like, Afghanistan was stable. The border was so stable. The COVID was under control. The economy was on the rebound. Like, so many things were going so well in a year ago.
All he had to do was nothing, and he'd have done well.
Which honestly, we could have expected him to do nothing. That's how he ran. He did nothing. And so, but the fact that he got in and rolled up his sleeves and immediately just went to work, just making a mess.
Yeah.
So no. And, you know, sadly, unfortunately, there's not a thing I can point to and say, oh, you know, President Biden's doing a great job in this, and I'd love to help him continue, because no, it's just not there. You know, it goes on and on. Labor force participation is down. Everything is down. Race relations are at probably a 50-year low in this country. And that's on the back of this, you know, this critical race theory agenda that the left is pushing, that's pervasive through our schools and our corporations and everything at this point. And it's toxic, it's poisonous, it's racist, it's divisive, and it's supposed to be. You know, it's supposed to be all of those things. That it's not a unifying theology, which is basically what it is. Yeah. Ideology is what I meant to say there. But you know, and that speaks to crime, because when you make everything, when you view the world through this lens of equity over safety, and we make these issues about crime and behavior about social justice and different things like that, and we vilify police and we make policing illegal. You know, the defund the police just basically turned into, well, let's just make it impossible to police. Yeah. You know, all of that in the name of social justice and racial reconciliation or something, but you don't get that. You know, if you go to a high crime area and you make it harder to police, you don't get less crime, you get more crime. You know, you see places like the super woke cities like San Francisco that have basically tried to decriminalize what they call petty crime. Mm-hmm. Well, you get more of all kinds of crime. So murder's up, shoplifting's up, everything's kind of a disaster.
That's kind of the broken window theory.
Yeah, it is. It's very much the broken window policing theory. And all of that's, you know, that's locally driven stuff, but it's all Democrat mayors. It's all Democrat leadership. And it's all top-down driven from Joe Biden and his party.
Yeah, the policing is getting harder and harder. I mean, that 25 years that mm-hmm. I was in it is totally different than what it is now. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend young people go into policing, and as much as it was a great career for me, mm-hmm. I'm glad I did it. I wouldn't go back and do it now.
Yeah, the respect's just not there. It's, I mean, no. You've got to constantly...
Well, the support's not there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Without that support and without the people, when people do bad things, they need to be separated from society as far as, you know, if they can be rehabilitated, awesome. Mm-hmm. But they've got to stay in jail to get rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. You can't just put them all up in a cushy apartment mm-hmm. and say, you know, you're free to go and do whatever you want to do, because it has no effects. Some people are just bad people.
Some people are just bad people, but a lot.
Not all of them.
Not, yeah, but some people, you know, at an 18-year-old who makes a mistake needs to pay consequences and be, like you said, rehabilitated.
Be given that second chance.
Or at 20 and 25, you know, like it escalates. It doesn't get better. It gets worse without mitigation and without remediation. And making it harder for police and law enforcement and that process to work. You know, cities that aren't prosecuting no longer prosecuting nonviolent crimes. Well, guess what? You're going to see an uptick in eventually is violent crimes.
Absolutely, it does escalate. It's a training mm-hmm. ground.
Yeah,
the more it happens, we've got people with multiple arrests and mm-hmm. and for serious offenses that are just turned loose and they're going out here and then they're committing murder.
Yeah,
and you know, you can say no, that's not how. Yeah, it is what's happening.
Yeah.
So hopefully, should you be lucky enough to be elected here, hopefully you'll be able to do something about that and at least make your voice heard and mm-hmm. try and get things turned around in those areas. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, Byron, and I got it right. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you and talk to you about coming on to your program, helping you out, mm-hmm. Knocking doorknobs doorbells, all that kind of stuff. How would they get in touch with you and become a part of your campaign?
Yeah, thank you for teeing that up for me. You know, because we do need volunteers. We need folks on the phones. We need folks pounding on doors for us. And the website's gatewoodforgeorgia.com. It's Gatewood, just like it sounds, for Georgia. all spelled out there, and you can sign up to volunteer there. You can donate online there, and we're building something. So it's really growing. It's a lot of fun, and we're really optimistic about what we're going to be able to do in this race, and then ultimately in the seat.
Well, Byron, I wish you a lot of luck. There's a lot of stuff going on in this county, a lot of stuff going on in the United States. Mm-hmm. We've got to have some strong people that are willing to get out there and fight. And, the more the board gets there, the more it looks like there's going to be what they call a red wave. But I don't put any – I wouldn't bet on anything right now.
Yep.
So the best I can say is on each individual is good luck.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, and we definitely don't win until we win. You know that the media is going to give – they're going to give every Democrat every second chance, every mulligan. They're going to give them all the top cover that they can. So I appreciate this opportunity in the media to come out and spread the good word there. But yeah, we definitely have to be vigilant. We've got to raise money. We've got to stay in front of this thing because Democrats are definitely – they have an upper hand.
Yeah, they do. They've got the media behind them 100%. Well, thank you for joining us on Case in Point, presented by Paradigm Security Services and in part by Soulsby's Garage and the Mana Scholarship Fund. Be sure to join us for the live broadcast every other Wednesday at 11:30 a.m. here on Business Radio X. If you miss the live broadcast, no worries. You can enjoy the show anytime by visiting businessradiox.com, selecting the Gwinnett Studio, and then, of course, clicking on Case in Point. This program is also available on iTunes, iHeart, Spotify, and I'll say that again, Spotify, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to Case in Point, and so you don't miss any of our future episodes. Thank you to my guest, Byron Gatewood, and I appreciate you coming on, and Miss Amanda for producing the show. I'm Rick Strawn, and remember, at Paradigm Security Services, we cover more than just your assets.